Magnesium plays a critical role in vital bodily functions, including energy production, heart health, immunity, and more restful sleep. Magnesium is ubiquitous in metabolic pathways that affect virtually all organ systems. So I'm excited to tell you about MagSRT from Jigsaw Health. MagSRT has rightfully earned a reputation as the most popular, most bioavailable, and best-tolerated magnesium brands in the world. The developers of MagSRT have solved a problem that deters many from getting adequate intake of elemental magnesium. Their unique formulation is gentle on the stomach and doesn't produce unwanted GI effects. Jigsaw Health also offers MagSoothe, a great-tasting, fast-acting, calming magnesium glycinate powder that helps relax your legs, muscles, and brain for better sleep. Jigsaw MagSoothe helps you fall asleep faster, sleep better, and reduces leg cramps. For more information and to order MagSRT and MagSoothe, just go to jigsawhealth.com. That's jigsawhealth.com. Use coupon code HOFFMAN10 for $10 off your order. That's jigsawhealth.com and use code HOFFMAN10 for MagSRT and MagSoothe. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's focus is on herbal medicine and herbology. With me is Dr. Bill Rawls. He's an MD and author of The Cellular Wellness Solution, which is a wonderful encyclopedic book. I recommend it very highly for a comprehensive discussion about natural herbs, also, you know, talking about the use of vitamins and supplements, but with a special focus on herbal products. Bill Rawls has dedicated his life to medicine, and when a health crisis arose in his early 40s, changed his quality of life. He came face to face with the limitations of modern medicine. There's a backstory to his career arc, and he began to explore the vast possibilities of alternative treatments. And the result is this magnum opus, The Cellular Wellness Solution. He restored his health through holistic and herbal therapies, and that inspired him to share his revelations on the importance of, and this is, I think, an important term, cellular wellness, not just in a laser-like fashion using magic bullets to vanquish microbes, cancer, etc., but to kind of address the terrain, the underlying circumstances that dictate whether we're resistant to disease or not. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bill Rawls. Bill, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your career, because obviously, you know, you, like I, had a conventional medical training, and I guess, at least in the beginning of your career, you practiced as a orthodox medicine physician. So how did you, what brought about your interest in a more natural approach?
Yeah, I think we all have a story. And I started my career in OBGYN because it was dealing with a healthy young population and bringing life into the world. And it was really exciting. But 30 years ago, less now, but 30 years ago, that required the obligation of taking call in the hospital for labor and delivery and the emergency room every second to third day, every second to third weekend. And generally, when I was on call, I didn't get sleep. But in my 30s, I could do it. As I reached the end of my 40s, though, it started catching up with me. And I thought, you know, it's not just the sleep. You know, if I could just, you know, I finally stopped doing OB call. I was forced to. I thought, well, everything will just get better. And it didn't. I just kept on this track of developing symptoms, heart symptoms, brain symptoms, all of these, just gut. Everything. My joints were falling apart. My whole body was falling apart, but not enough to really define me as having a definitive diagnosis. So I had symptoms that were consistent with MS. You know, I had headaches. I had all these bizarre symptoms, but nothing really bad enough to get me the help that I thought I needed. I ended up, you know, satisfying with a diagnosis of fibromyalgia. And nobody really wants that because just, you know, you get drugs for symptoms and that's about it.
Yeah, it's a wastebasket diagnosis. It's like in the absence of anything more compelling, you know, we kind of put you in that basket. And it's kind of like, you know, the millions and millions of walking wounded sometimes are designated as sufferers of fibromyalgia. Yep.
So kept searching, like many people with fibromyalgia, found that I had was carrying the microbes associated, the bacteria associated with Lyme disease, and thought, hey, that's it. You know, to antibiotics, I'm going to get well.
Quick fix.
And took several rounds of antibiotics and just got sicker instead of better. Wrecked my gut. Everything got worse. And was at a place that I just felt really kind of abandoned by the medical system. And it was a dark place, to say the least. But just started scrapping and rethinking, you know, what was this all about? And it caused me to really rethink a lot of the things that I had been trained in medical school, started seeking out alternative and complementary therapies, became certified in holistic medicine eventually. But I still wasn't getting all the way better, and finally aligned with an herbal protocol that was set up for Lyme disease. Now, I was taking handfuls of capsules, all these powerful herbal extracts, and thinking that, you know, if antibiotics made me sick, these things were going to make me worse. And I just kept getting better every month. And over a five-year period, got all my life back, and all the symptoms just gradually dissolved. And from then, I've spent the rest of my life really figuring out why. What do the herbs do, and why is that so important, and how can we all learn from that?
Well, you know, Lyme disease, or fibromyalgia, as the case may be, because they're sometimes indistinguishable, is sort of a combination of factors. It could be an infection, which requires antimicrobials, and so perhaps the herbs serve that purpose, but it's also an inflammatory disorder. To some extent, it's a brain disorder. It's also a joint disorder in many cases. So, you know, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about how herbs can have and it, to some extent, it's an adrenal disorder, you know, because it may have an impact on overall energy metabolism, because, you know, when the adrenals are wiped out due to burnout, which you were subject to, that could be a component of your malaise. So perhaps you could speak to how herbs, you know, may have an advantage over conventional medicine in addressing some of these issues.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first started looking at herbs, I looked at what we knew. I looked at all the traditional herbal traditions, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, but those were all based on observation and really didn't have the science. But fortunately, starting about 30 years ago, and really over the past 20 years, there have been scientists all around the world really looking at how herbs work at a biochemical level. And I think that's very important. So what you just said kind of illustrates how we think in conventional medicine. We compartmentalize it. Mm-hmm. So we have our joints, rheumatology, we have our heart, cardiology, and we divide everything up into systems. And so a lot of the orientation of how we treat chronic illness is treating the manifestations of illness, not the underlying causes. And that's a big reason why a lot of people never get well, because we're not addressing those underlying factors. So when I started looking at this, it carried me all the way down to the cellular level, because if you want to break something down to, if you want to really understand something at the most simple level, break it down to its smallest functional unit. And that's not an organ. It's not a system. It's not a tissue. It's a living cell. So when you look at the body as a complex collection of living cells and start explaining symptoms by cells, you start thinking completely differently. Because all cells, whether you're talking about a heart cell or a liver cell or a skin cell or a thyroid cell, all cells need five basic things to function. They need the right nutrients. Now, that's different for different cells, but if you're eating a whole food diet, you're going to cover that. They need a clean environment. So all these low-grade toxic substances we're exposed to affect our cells. It's basically like throwing sand into the machinery of your cells. It's going to slow it down. It can still work, but it's not going to work as well, and it's going to burn out faster. Our cells need downtime to recover from that, from working all day. So some cells, like heart cells, rest in between beats, but most of our cells, well, we need a good night's sleep for our cells to recover and repair. Fourth, all of our cells need good blood flow from being physically active. And fifth, we need protection from microbes. And when we look at that microbe factor, when we look at the Lyme microbes and all the rest, these aren't high-grade pathogens. These are low-grade pathogens. And the evidence of that is that most people that are bitten by a tick that's carrying Borrelia, the microbe associated with Lyme disease, don't get acutely ill.
Yep.
95% of the people I've talked to in the past 10 years, this is thousands of people, don't remember a tick bite or becoming ill around the tick bite.
Mm-hmm.
And that was me too. I probably picked these things up when I was a kid. And the interesting thing is I'm finding in the research that what's happening is when we're bitten by ticks, when we, you know, start putting things in our mouths when we're a kid, when we're exposed to these low-grade pathogens, we either get mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. And we think, well, that microbe's gone. But that's not necessarily the case. There's a concept I've been studying called microbe dormancy, that microbes can slip past our immune system's defenses and invade cells. And if cells are healthy, they just become dormant. So there's evidence that we actually have a microbiome of the brain. And, you know, they're finding microbes in all of our different tissues.
The previous notion was, of course, the brain is sterile, there's a blood-brain barrier, there's no way, no how that there could be any microbes, whether fungal organisms, viruses, or bacteria that could breach that impregnable barrier. But actually, there's a new concept that even the brain, the most sequestered protected organ, has a microbiome.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So wherever they look deeply enough, now it's hard to accumulate this evidence because it's hard to chop up healthy people. You know, we just don't do that. But slowly this evidence is accumulating, and it really explains a lot about chronic illness. So if you can imagine, things are crossing through your system all the time. Things are crossing across the gut, from our sinuses, from our skin, entering the bloodstream, and they end up in different parts of our body. And if they're in a dormant state, we don't have symptoms, tests are negative, we're not aware of them. But when you become stressed chronically, not enough sleep, eating the wrong food, exposure to toxic substances or mold, all these things come together, then they start to reactivate. And when they do, they start breaking down cells and basically making a food supply out of your tissues to grow more microbes. And that's what's driving a lot of the symptoms. So that starts to explain these really weird symptoms that people have with chronic Lyme and fibromyalgia and a lot of other chronic illnesses. But going beyond that, looking at illnesses like multiple sclerosis, you know, we found connections between Borrelia. I talked to one practitioner that says he's never had an MS patient that didn't test positive for Borrelia, but also chlamydia, Epstein-Barr virus, all of these other microbes have been associated.
I was going to bring up that point because it is thought that, I mean, there's scholarly papers now that say that Epstein-Barr virus or EBV, which is the virus that causes mono, is associated, and I put you know, the Dr. Evil quotes around associated with MS. The problem is that virtually the entire population has been exposed to Epstein-Barr virus. It is the rare person right. who's not had a, maybe even a subclinical or mild case of mono at some point. And they don't even know it. And they harbor this virus, which is a forever virus. It's, you know, it's latent, as you say. So that's actually adds fuel to your theory that we harbor these latent, infectious organisms, and that it is our terrain or our immune system or our resistance or resilience that impacts whether they take us down in terms of symptoms or illness.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, when you look at Epstein-Barr, it's one of many. And, you know, we have a list of viruses, but also protozoa, yeast, bacteria, and the list grows every year. But, you know, when we look at Lyme disease, I mean, 50 years ago, nobody had ever heard of Borrelia. And 2017, when I wrote a book Unlocking Lyme, there were 12 species of Borrelia that had been identified that could cause Lyme disease. It's up to 21 now. Mm. And all the Lyme sufferers will tell you, well, there's all the co-infections, Bartonella, Babesia, Anaplasma, Rickettsia. Mm-hmm. But all of these things are relatively low-grade pathogens. They have the potential not to cause acute illness, but to become dormant inside tissues. And, you know, so when you have all these stress factors, when you look at this situation, it's not technically an infection. So I define an infection as when a microbe first enters the body for the first time. You know, that's the new onset. And the symptoms that go with that are basically the skirmish between the immune system and the microbe. But by the time you have this reactivation syndrome, it's not one thing, it's a lot of things all at once. And a lot of those things may be working together to create that environment that favors microbe growth. So it's an interesting way to look at chronic illness that starts kind of crossing the boundaries between diagnoses and what is what, that is really fascinating.
So this is the theoretical basis for utilizing herbs and natural medicine to support cellular wellness. So let's look at some particulars. You know, what are some of the key nutrients or herbs, supplements that can support cellular wellness?
Well, you know, this is the fascinating thing about the herbs. When you look at that scenario I just described, herbs are really a perfect solution for that. Because when you take an herb, you're basically taking the plant's defense and regulatory system. So plants are multicellular organisms just like we are. They don't have a cellular immune system. They basically have a chemical immune system.
They don't have white blood cells, an army of white blood cells that can be mobilized to attack invaders.
So plants and fungi and even bacteria are using this chemical defense system. Mm-hmm. But it's more than just defending against microbes. So when you look at this spectrum of chemicals that we call phytochemistry of the plant, mm-hmm. it includes substances that are blocking free radicals, toxic substances, affecting radiation, but especially a wide range of microbes, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, yeast. And some plants have stronger antimicrobial properties than others because it depends on the microbe stress in the plant's natural environment. But all plants have some antimicrobial properties. That's really been fascinating to appreciate. All of our plants,
phytoalexins, which are actually enhanced in plants when they're subject to thermal stress, too hot, too cold, you know, a little bit of drought. It's the kind of thing that actually improves the flavor of wines. You know, they say it's been a good season because it's mostly been sunny, but there was a cold snap. And it really enhanced the flavor, but that's the signature of some of these natural substances that are employed by plants to increase their resistance, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's not one substance like an antibiotic. It's hundreds of different chemicals But with that, you get a certain intelligence about it that the when you take an herb, it tends to be selected for pathogens. So it doesn't disrupt normal flora in the gut. You know, when I started taking herbs, I was expecting exactly if they were actually killing microbes in my body, that I was going to have the same effect I did with antibiotics. I didn't. My gut kept getting better and better and better. And finally, recently, I found a study that somebody had actually looked at that and found that, you know, plants, herbs suppress pathogens without disrupting normal flora. Well, that's really important because that means you can take them for a long time. And when you look at this chronic reactivation of microbes, you know, they're growing very slowly. Antibiotics work really well for fast-growing bacteria. But when you look at this spectrum of bacteria and viruses and protozoa and yeast, the plant is going to cover for all of those things without disrupting your normal flora. So you can take herbs for months or even years without having these ill effects. And you're getting this secondary effect of protecting your cells against all these other stress factors. Even most herbs have anti-diabetic properties that they can protect your cells from overconsumption of carbohydrates. But you're also getting the regulatory parts of the plant. You know, plants have to regulate cellular functions. They're multicellular just like we are. And they're using a lot of the same chemical messengers. So it's not surprising that many of our herbs, especially our adaptogens, can help balance stress hormones and other hormones in the body. So it has this overall normalizing effect and protective effect. So it makes the herbs really powerful for solving that particular problem.
There's a theory that we have co-evolved with plant foods, and that we have developed ways of properly utilizing them to enhance our function. And this is something that has occurred, you know, not over centuries or even millennia, but over millions of years. You know, even our pre-primate ancestors have that capability when they consume various types of vegetation. And then, of course, there's the cultures. You know, I was an anthropology major and we studied, you know, medical anthropology and how various tribes use certain herbs in a rational system to address various maladies. So is it possible that we have certain receptors built into our bodies or our cells that respond well to plant materials?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. That, you know, when you look at drugs, most drugs are hard on your liver, right? Because your liver has to process that.
Yeah, they're synthetic.
It's a foreign chemical substance. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, most herbs actually promote normal liver function and help protect liver cells. So it would suggest maybe there's a long-term relationship there. And when you look at it, humans for hundreds of thousands of years ate a foraged diet. And it's coming out now that that foraged diet was about 2/3 plant matter and maybe 1/3 animal. Mm-hmm. So we were eating a lot of plants. It's estimated that our ancient ancestors might eat 500 different plants in a year. But these were wild plants. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's happened to our food and cultivation of our food, we have de-stressed our plants. We have selected out and we train them to produce calories. So they've given up a lot of those protective properties.
That's flavor characteristics and durability so that they stay shelf stable for an eternity. So many times I've been snookered because I go and it's the summer season and I want like a really great tasting peach and they look great. And then I bite into them and they're just completely tasteless. And, you know, it's all about shelf life and appearance.
Sure. Yeah. No doubt about it. But it's also all about calories. You know, our plants are really cultivated to produce calories. So they've given up a lot of those protective properties that their wild ancestors had. Mm-hmm. So our ancient ancestors were eating wild plants. And they were eating a lot of plant material so that they were basically eating the equivalent of herbs by the poundful every day. So when we started changing over to agriculture, we switched to seeds, which have the lowest phytochemical concentration of anything you can do. But even when we switched to seeds, beans, and grains for as our primary food supply, you know, humans kept those culinary and medicinal herbs as part of their normal daily diet. And we gave that up about 100 years ago, and I think we're suffering from it.
Okay, well, great. You've laid the groundwork for our discussion in part two. I want to talk particulars, you know, some of your favorite herbs, herbal formulas. You also have a wonderful website. The book is The Cellular Wellness Solution. And your website, I believe, is Vital Plan. Is that correct?
Uh-huh. Vitalplan.com.
Vitalplan.com. And as a special offer to our Intelligent Medicine listeners, you can sample some of the products at Vital Plan by using discount code IntelMed20. That's a generous offer on your behalf, Dr. Rawls, for 20% off their first Vital Plan product order. And we'll talk a little bit about what those supplements entail and your philosophy about supplements. Are you into single supplements? Are you into formulas? You know, what are some of the different considerations when selecting herbal products in part two? I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. The book we're discussing today, The Cellular Wellness Solution, an encyclopedic book about herbs and natural therapies. Our guest, Dr. Bill Rawls, MD, author of The Cellular Wellness Solution. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back.